This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
14 years ago, I jumped in my little car in Oakland and drove to the clinic with a minor but mysterious complaint. No one could help me. But one harried nurse said, "Well, you're gay. It's probably AIDS." 6 weeks later, complaint yet unanswered, I was unconscious, comatose, and so began a year of the brutest kind of medicalization. "His whole body is under attack," they said, turning me into a war zone. It seems appropriate that it's the 11th of September today. "We have to get in there and eradicate whatever this is." The militarization continued. They talked of ground zero, of battle plans, treatment regimes. Aaron? We're going to work out the slide thing. Yeah, there we go. They pored over the vast library of images they took of me inside and out, like some kind of precursor to drone culture, zeroing in on or pinpointing the targets. They took pictures like these of the inside of my eyes and showed them to me once I was awake again, in horror and a strange kind of moral indignation, as if I were somehow responsible for the images my retinas had produced, as if I too should join their holy crusade, not only against the etiology of my collapse, but also against the images themselves, fractured and inchoate as they are. Go ahead. But what struck me most about these pictures, and what strikes me most now, is their strange, if haunted, beauty. The first time I saw images like these, I remember thinking and then saying out loud, "These are gorgeous. Who is the photographer?" This did not occasion a happy response from anyone in the room, with one exception, my then retinal surgeon, who chuckled to himself, leaned down to my bed, and said, "We're going to work well together." But I was then, and am still now, left wondering, what are these images? What do they show? What do they hide? How do they work? What is the temporality of their being? How and what do they mean? Go ahead. Like Pluto or Jupiter, they seem proud of their secrets, even as they seem to want to be seen. Like painting, they betray the brushstrokes of their authors. Hear the movement of a passionate strain across the tenderest stretch of retinal skin. Like sculpture, they are substantial, but they also change in time, more Eva Hesse than Auguste Rodin. Go ahead. What strikes me, too, is the tenderness they evoke in me when I look at them, like letters from distant kin. Maybe this is because they live with me still, chosen family without the choice, but somehow chosen nonetheless. Maybe this is because illness and its effects can never be fully resolved, but circulate somewhere deep, popping up to the surface just when you least expect them, more as reminder than ungainly threat. These images hide in plain sight, pure exposure, pure obfuscation. In this, they resemble the glorious, astonishing, and yes, terrifying images that have recently repopulated our collective visual imaginary of a total solar eclipse. If this seems almost too perfect a comparison, please consider with me Annie Dillard's elegant incantation of a 1979 eclipse in Yakima, Washington. And I'm sure some of you have read this recently. It became very popular again a few weeks ago. She writes, "People on all the hillsides screamed when the body of the moon detached from the sky and rolled over the sun. But something else was happening at that same instant, and it was this, I believe, which made us scream. The second before the sun went out, we saw a wall of shadow come speeding at us. We no sooner saw it than it was upon us, like thunder. It roared up the valley. It slammed our hill and knocked us out. It was the monstrous, swift shadow cone of the moon. I have since read that this wave of shadow moves 1,800 miles an hour. Language can give no sense of this sort of speed. 1,800 miles an hour. No end was in sight. You saw only the edge. It rolled at you across the land at 1,800 miles an hour, hauling darkness like plague behind it. Seeing it and knowing it was coming straight for you was like feeling a slug of anesthetic shoot up your arm. If you think very fast, you may have time to think, soon it will hit my brain. You can feel the deadness race up your arm. You can feel the appalling, inhuman speed of your own blood. We saw the wall of shadow coming, and we screamed before it hit. Total exposure, total obfuscation. These polar opposites describe complex visuality, and they also describe the complex event of being itself that obtains such ultimate significance only in the context of finitude, of mortality, of ceasing to be. What astonished Dillard as she was enveloped by darkness on that hill in 1979 was this: the source of all light, the source of all sight, was suddenly gone. And so she found herself there on that hill, facing the brink of being itself. We saw the wall of shadow coming, and we screamed before it hit. These images have a similar effect on me. The paradox at their core is that they force me to see my own blindness, and through that, my own ends. Total exposure, total obfuscation. So I'm beginning with these meditations on this strange photographic practice and with these haunted images because they help to characterize for me the ways in which sight and seeing and beauty and being touch precisely where we least expect them to. For me, as I lay dying at the sight of mortality itself. Or, as Mary Oliver intones, maybe death isn't darkness after all, but so much light wrapping itself around us, as soft as feathers, that we are instantly weary of looking and looking and shut our eyes, not without amazement, and let ourselves be carried, as through the translucence of mica, to the river that is without the least dapple or shadow, that is nothing but light, scalding aortal light, in which we are washed and washed out of our bones. And because the authors of these images, the artists who brought them into being, were a cluster of virulent, drug-resistant bacteria, they also clarify my motivation in writing this book to turn to the narrative agency of non-human beings to describe the indescribable. I turned to those beings, and they then evoked, again in Annie Dillard's words, the universe about which we have read so much and never before felt. This is the opening section of the book. What it was we had to tell him couldn't have been said in whispers, shouts, or sighs, but only in the ancient tongue of death, of falling sick and dying young. What it was we had to tell him had been haunting us for years, a nagging voice in the back of our own minds, like the most guttural sob or the heartiest of belly laughs, like newborn hair, like wind after rain, like a sunset in smog, like an egg, perfect and perfectly clear. What it was we had to tell him we could not ourselves understand, not in the way that he would. It was a message from a cause to the victim of an effect. We did not mind that it was ours to tell him. We only prolonged the telling because it felt so good to know that we had not told him yet. We have so very little to look forward to. Thank you for that. But we begin with the story of our own origins, of our halting starts in the world. We were born of a resolute mother. Her voice was chewed by cigarettes and whiskey, or so it would seem to those of you who have access to the domain of sound. She is a tiny thing, And if everyone calls her the little terror, it is only because such strength rarely comes in packages as small as her. She prowls the routes and ways to which she has access with a hunger satiable only by multiplication. The sense we sometimes get that others are becoming more and more like us. The sense that the world is conforming to our singular notion of what it should be. The sense that we grow larger by convincing others that there is no other way but ours. And she has never been defeated, not really, though her form has changed dramatically over the years. This is her greatest defense, a mutability the Greeks personified and named Morpheus, a name ironically recognizable now in the chemicals that provide fleeting release from the pain our mother can cause. She responds to threat with the ultimate bait and switch, modulating her slow, sinuous assault just enough to avoid any reactionary blows. She knows her itinerary well, though, and does not waver from it. Her object is life, her aim is expansion, and her method is to sneak unseen, or without raising an alarm, through whatever back door she can find. Her name isn't easy on the tongue. Some call her Mirsa, a lyrical name, a name that sings, but she prefers the longer version, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. She likes to say, or would if she could, that hearing it makes her proud. This is a complicated pride. The first word in her name was shared by a lover who, like most lovers, ended up breaking her heart and almost destroying her entirely. She once thought, like many, maybe most, that this lover was destined for her, fashioned from the start as her perfect complement, that mythical other half for whom she had always been searching. Go ahead. And when that love failed, as love so often does, she thought that it was she herself, not her lover, not the pairing, not the circumstances through which they had found one another, who was flawed. The loss of love made her desperate to survive. The loss of faith in love made her determined to reinvent herself so that survival was no longer in question. And in the years since that particular love failed, she has stretched out in so many directions that she is now only barely recognizable. Like a master linguist, her vocabularies of expansion are so vast, so subtly insistent, so treacherously unrelenting, that she rarely finds someone with whom she is unable to commune. Like empathy unchecked, she so gracefully moves from one station in life to another that you might mistake her enthusiasm for kindness or concern. But just as this appetite for travel is not buoyed by an underlying compassion for those she does not know, neither is it driven by apathy, hatred, or greed. She is not a monster. Like most of us, and maybe you, she is simply wounded, fragile in spite of her fortitude. It would be unbecoming and somehow dishonest for her to give up and pass away. We can tell this story, what is essentially his, Patrick's story, because we know it best, from the inside out, as it were. We are the branch of our mother's family tree that touched him, that invested him with unwanted significance, and that altered forever who he was and will have been. There are so many causes for illness, so many etiologies of disease, but ours may be most base. We can take away your life, give you in greedy palms your final shudder and gasp, send you briefly but terrifically reeling through the final moments of the minuscule existence that defines who and what you are. We are that serious and we are that strong. We have survived your many attempts to eradicate us, after all, and we know, better than you, how desperately you depend on us to stay alive. But when you attack, especially if you think you've won, you won't even see us coming. In short, we creep. The truth is that we come to depend upon you. In this case, it happens slowly. First, we were there with him because he provided a safe space for us to be. Then, unwillingly perhaps, just out of trust for what the experts told him, he began to fight us, believing that we were all harm. And achingly, we grew stronger, learning the tricks of the tactics they used to hunt and eliminate us, dodging every bullet by the slightest of margins. We learned to be tenacious from our mother, and it took every gram of strength we had just to survive all that they threw of us. But we held our ground for his benefit as much as our own, and we dragged him forward through the early phase more than the last, by pulling out from his memory store other voices, other rooms. We dragged him forward by summoning visions, remembrances of his fractured past, and this allowed us to work unhindered, even as we watched his flashbacks and dreams as if they were our own. We grew to care for him then, or started to, as we watched. The love came later. It took us utterly by surprise. What might it mean for us to imagine the microbes that sometimes generate illness in terms other than those characterized by war and aggression? What might it mean for us to consider the dreams and desires of microbes and other things? A fragment of bone, excavated skin, retinal tissues altered by new inhabitants. How might our sense of being, even or especially when being is under threat, be complicated and nuanced by turning towards a broader sense of beauty? A beauty derived not from careful human deliberation, but from what Kaja Silverman describes in World Spectators as the complex event of appearance initiated by non-human beings, objects, and things themselves. Can we imagine that encounter and that event in terms of love? Go back one. I think that's a bit early. We'll get to it. This is again from the book. How are we doing? Everyone with me? You're in the flow? All right. If I, you can interrupt at any point if you feel like the rhythm is moving us on. But I don't have too much more to do here. Late one night, as those he now knew to be doctors explained what they would do to him the following day, explanations that were so dry, so matter-of-fact, so short on any descriptive value whatsoever, that he found himself falling asleep. He was jarred out of his disorienting boredom when one of them casually began describing what remained of his thigh in the following way. What happens when we remove part of a bone is that it begins to return in unexpected ways. This from the same young resident as months ago, the one who had drawn his leg and then signed it like art. Patrick sat up. What do you mean return? How can a bone return? The doctor too seemed surprised. Well, it begins to reshape itself. Patrick glanced to his left. But it's bone, and it's gone. What it is there to reshape? The doctor was out of his depths. He stuttered as he grasped for any adjective he could find, any verb, any noun for that matter, to clarify. It's difficult to explain. Apparently so, Patrick said, without thinking. And then, with apologies to anyone in the room, remembering that most doctors prefer being misunderstood to being criticized, he tried to recover. You mean it regenerates? It grows back? Well, regenerate is too strong a word, but it does start to grow. It tries to find itself. It begins experimenting. Sounds like a student. More like an artist, like a sculptor. It starts to shape itself in unexpected ways, sometimes out of control. You know, like cancer. Patrick began to feel faint. Like cancer? Wait. Like cancer or cancer? What are you telling me? And with apologies to doctors, the doctor was back on stable ground. Here again was a patient looking for that calming effect that doctors become doctors so that they can provide. This is what they call helping people. He had chosen his metaphor well. He smiled. The good news is you don't have cancer. But your bone, the place where we cut your bone, the bone that remains is continuing to grow. This is a good sign. It's healthy. We've cured it. Like a sculptor. Like sculpture. Yeah, like sculpture, but there's a problem. It will keep growing if we don't stop it. Like sculpture. Why does that sound so beautiful? It isn't. We have to stop it. It can't continue to grow. Patrick thought, then said, "How do you stop a sculptor from sculpting? That sounds so violent." The doctor cleared his throat, impatient now with his own metaphor. "This is what's going to happen. You'll go in for surgery. We'll put in the rod, the screws, the pins, move you to the recovery room, wait for you to wake up, and then we'll take you to radiation. Don't think about it now, just rest. See you in pre-op." And then they were gone, as abruptly as they'd appeared. It may surprise you to learn that many artifacts of the so-called natural world are our family's creations. We are at base all artists, and we take great pleasure in the objects we shape. Your scientists recently found that when you strip a snowflake down to its core, there you may find one of our cousins, drifting gracefully and graciously down in a kind cocoon of ice. Many of the most heart-wrenching colors to be found are mixed by us, the products of a diligent chemical choreography we use to make our homes feel safe. We even work in the medium of taste, for example, wine, cheese. Though Patrick had long been an intimate of the aesthetic domain, he had never consciously considered the arts of things. He had noticed that things could be beautiful with or without human intervention, but he had never before been aware of the deep and rigorous sense of beauty that even the most unthinking objects carry within themselves. In other words, it had never occurred to him to believe that things might act upon beauty. A plant turning slowly towards the light, he thought, was pure functionality, not grace. A cave that moaned with the wind was just the physics of sound, not a song, not a cry, not a plea for someone to answer back. For humans, this can't be true. Humans are only humans, you seem to believe, so long as objects are there to be used or useful or at the very least still. But we work well in and with, for this is a shared world we are in, even for those you call things, all kinds of mediums. Patrick now knew this intimately. Muscle, retina, bone, and blood, each had been home to us. Each we had crafted into something we could use, and with each we had learned to commune. We were neither ill-trained nor ill-suited for this. Our family's work, especially in that strongest of all human material, bone, has an ancient heritage. It is work that predates the earliest humans by millions of years. Paleopathology, you call it. The study of prehistoric illness. Your scientists have traced it in dinosaurs, like the abscess preserved in the fossilized remains of the wonderfully named Allosaurus fragilis. And in humans, too, but always through bone. Patrick had seen our imprint on bone, had tracked our movement there in the images of scans that now filled his files. He sometimes looked at them just for their beauty, setting aside the pangs of sorrow and dread that had accompanied their original manufacture. He thought often of that word that so many doctors now had used to describe them, lace. This evoked for him such bright and immaculate simplicity, a language of humble splendor, a rhetoric of intimate, care-filled design. He would sit immersed in lace's invocations, letting them fill him like so much nostalgia, and in that sitting, he made room for us, setting aside for a spell the unresolved, unresolvable antagonism at the heart of illness's plea. We're nearing the end. I want so much from the countless images like these, and like the ones with which I began tonight. I want them to say something like channeling Roland Barthes. He is not yet dead. He is not yet going to die. Even as they offer the slimmest glimpse of he who will have been. And again, in Mary Oliver's words, we are instantly wearying of looking and looking and shut our eyes, not without amazement. And we are washed and washed out of our bones in that river of aortal light. Or, as the bacteria themselves describe at the end of the book, there is value in deviation, in resistance, in mutation, in acting out. Imagine a form of being that focuses on the falling down and falling away of indignant separation, the embrace of interdependence, sweeping sociality. Being with is a better model for survival than standing alone. All of this is to say, we have helped to tell you this story, Patrick, because we know that you do not remember it and so cannot tell it yourself. We have told you this story so as to release you from the tight, tangled pressure to be able to speak from the posture of illness, to be able to narrate an experience that defies the very logic of experience. We have told you this story because you needed to hear it most of all, from someone or ones you could trust. We have told you this story because it is all that we know, and because we wanted to tell it, and because otherwise it would forever be held in your sinew and bones, remembered in fractured pieces by the parts that experienced it most forcibly, but never resolving into a whole. We have told you this story because it is our story too, and stories need to be told. Like us, you will shift and change, turning into other selves, turning on the selves you've been, turning back in repetition to find and see yourself as you are, as you were, as you, like all of us, one day simply will have been. There is beauty in ending. There is beauty in ends. Seek to find it. For with each and every single thing, alongside the troubled but no less immaculate splendor of being, there is always an end. There is always an end.